शिला गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की जय, श्री श्री दाऊद जी गोपाल की जय, तिरुबाब महोत्सव तिथि श्री जयदेव गोस्वामी की जय, गौर भक्तवृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू। Good morning from Sri Madhavan. And today, as you may know, our Guru Maharaj is not giving his usual Swami Sunday Swami call, and we were also giving some further Ishtagosis meetings of Q&As here, so we thought it may be a good moment to also share not only with the ones present here in Madhavan, but with those who are accustomed to connect at this time, at this day of the week. So here we are, trying to engage, as we mentioned, in Ishtagosti, or the very fruitful interaction among peers, if you will, or among like-minded people, basically, in that sense, peers, and inquiring with sincerity and humility, and trying to invoke proper answers according to what Shastra and common sense dictates. So I don't know if anyone has any question. There is one question here to begin with. Let's see if they're also sending some. Okay. Yeah, I've seen two sent here. So, okay, I'm seeing two questions on the chat and one more question here. So I'll begin with one sent here regarding the one sent by Sarada. Sarada, I sent you one message today, and I directed you to one specific section of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu for your question on the Anugas in Vrindavan, because it's quite a comprehensive thing that may be too much to unfold here. So I think it's better you can go to that section 3.2 of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. That may be my answer to your question in this sense. So
thank you very much. No. That's really what I need.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I send you the file so you can go through it in detail. So let's go with
Thank you. I will.
Okay. There's one question here sent by Tarun Krishna Prabhu from Bulgaria. In connection to something I think I mentioned some weeks ago in one Q&A here, if you will remind me. So his question basically is, how can sex be Sangha Siddha Bhakti except if you do it with the intention for conceiving devotee child? I think I mentioned that at one point in one lecture, because he asked on that connection. So of course, first of all, I'll clarify why was the meaning of the question, was the meaning of Sangha Siddha Bhakti and so on. And somehow it's an interesting question in connection with today's celebration. We'll see how Sila Jayadev Goswami's Tirubhap Mahotsav. You may wonder what's the connection between that, but there is some connection. So to begin with, the question has to do with something, again, I think I mentioned in one Ishtagosti here some weeks ago, regarding sex being engaged in such a way that it may be counted as Sangha Siddha Bhakti. So what Sangha Siddha Bhakti? And also what sex? We will try to explain all the things. Sangha Siddha Bhakti is a term coined by Sri Jiva Goswami in his Bhakti Sandarbha. He speaks about three types of bhakti: Swarup Siddha Bhakti, Sangha Siddha Bhakti, and Arop Siddha Bhakti. And I won't enter into details of each of them, but Sangha Siddha Bhakti basically refers to those actions or activities which are not bhakti in themselves, which do not have inherent bhakti in themselves. What do I mean by this? Swarup Siddha Bhakti refers to those. Swarup Siddha Bhakti means those actions whose very essence, Swarup, is bhakti. Like for example, kirtan or parikata, Bhagavat Shravan, Dham Seva, now reciting the holy abode, studying Srimad Bhagavatam, and chanting the name of Krishna. All those activities can only be bhakti, basically. They are so much bhakti in their essence that they cannot be anything else. Even if you perform them unconsciously, still there are bhakti and have some bhakti impact on you, even while you are not aware of that. That's some examples we gave these days, Bhakti Abbas and the famous example given by Jiva Goswami of the mouse who was in one temple, and mouses like to eat. I mean, everyone likes to eat, mouses also. So in one temple, the mouse was in one temple and got these ghee wicks, we call this, no? Made with clarified butter that offered in the altar. So it started to eat the ghee wick, but the ghee wick still was on fire. The flame was there, so it got stuck on his face. And he started to get on fire and die. But he was in the temple in front of the altar. So the mouse was jumping and moving the head like this, like when you are offering like a ghee lamp. And it is said there in Shastra that that mouse, because of dying in such a way, he attained in the next lifetime devotion at birth as a queen and so on. So again, that speaks about the power of bhakti, how inherent bhakti is in those type of activities. So that's Swarup Siddha Bhakti. And Sangha Siddha Bhakti means refers to activities which are not bhakti in themselves, but can become bhakti by association with bhakti. For example, I don't know, having a bath, sleeping, eating, all these like basic human survival instincts, if you want to call them, they're not necessarily bhakti. It's not that every person who is having lunch, having a shower, are engaged in bhakti, not necessarily. But those persons who sing the name of Krishna even without knowing what's going on, they are engaging in bhakti unknowingly. So Sangha Siddha Bhakti means whatever I'm doing on my daily basis, which is not inherently bhakti, I make it bhakti by association with bhakti. So if I have, for example, I have to sleep, I'll sleep in a particular frame of mind. Like I'm going to rest, so my sadhaka deha, my body as practitioner, is properly healthy and balanced, so I can engage in bhakti. So I connect in my resting, not just I'm tired and I want to sleep, but I mean, this has a function in connection with bhakti. I'm eating, I'm maintaining the vehicle, basically, so it can properly direct me, engage me in bhakti. Not just because I'm hungry, because I'm tired, because I have this desire, that desire, because I do that because this will be favorable to have a balanced physical, emotional, whatever disposition for engaging in bhakti. You follow the point? So that's Sangha Siddha Bhakti. Activities which normally are ordinary, but can become extraordinary by association with bhakti. So the question, going back to the question is, or what I say is, sex can become Sangha Siddha Bhakti. There's the potential is there. What and the question is, how can sex be Sangha Siddha Bhakti, except if you do it with the intention of conceiving devotee child? In other words, the idea maybe sometimes the idea is, okay, the ideal, ultimate, perfect purpose of sexual union is procreation. So, how can something apart from that be considered Sangha Siddha Bhakti? Sometimes the idea maybe if you are having sex with other purpose other than procreation, that may go against bhakti even. Sometimes that's said. I'm not saying that, I'm saying other things. Of course, I will try to explain myself. sorry. So, although the proposal might sound like ideal, okay, the ideal purpose of sexual union is procreation, it's like saying, okay, the ideal purpose of anything is this or that. Not necessarily everyone is on that level. We have to be realistic. We have to be realistic even with practitioners of our tradition. Because actually, technically speaking, I've never found, to be honest, any quote in Shastra which says sex is only licit if you engage in for procreation. And whatever other form is illicit sex. Sometimes this phrase has been used, illicit sex. So it kind of creates some sort of like, okay, this is licit, this is illicit, whatever is licit is okay, whatever is illicit, it's not okay. It won't be nice for my practice, so let's avoid it. And you can use those terms even, and you can even demand that from others, but even you yourself may not be engaging in that. Like, to be realistic, of course, I generally do not make a survey on the devotee community about their standards, their sexual standards as couples. It's not my business. But in some of the cases, somehow I got to know about that because they shared their concerns or whatever. You generally can realize that most of the practitioners of bhakti who are married, who have a couple, I'm not speaking here about monastics like me or others, most of them are not able to only engage in sexual activity only for the purpose of procreation. So the point is how to deal with that. We just say one thing, do another, and do not say anything, and carry with some clandestine standards, while we just voice the ideal for everyone to follow, but mostly anyone is hardly following that. Or is there a way to understand this idea in a more elastic way, if you will, in a more accommodating way than just licit, illicit, in more like black and white terms? So what I will say to begin with, and this may take some time to unpack, so I don't know, hopefully we have time for other questions, or maybe not. Maybe hopefully we can unpack this enough. Because it's an issue, no? I mean, sometimes people... how to say it? In certain circles, everyone is speaking about certain topics in a way, but they are not speaking about that same topic in any other way. For example, everyone in the world is speaking about death, but only in a certain way. Like, this person died, this accident was here, 3,000 deaths of coronavirus, but almost nobody is speaking about the fact that we will die someday and how to deal with that. Even although everyone knows that will happen, nobody is speaking about that. But they are speaking about that in a totally different way. This died, this death, but not so much, I have the following one, and what to do with that. You follow. So with sex, maybe similar. Everyone is speaking about sex. But hardly anyone is speaking about how to deal with that properly, how to understand what's that, what's the background of that, what's the drive behind that drive. Drive, you say? Or the impulse behind what I feel like an impulse. So mostly anyone is speaking about it. Sometimes even anyone, not too many people in spiritual circles are speaking about that also. It becomes like kind of a taboo topic. Like, you solve that by yourself in your own house and situation. And yeah, of course, each one has to carry their own burden, but it's important to have some orientation, conceptual orientation, as our Guru Maharaj will say. So personally, I do not feel in a realistic sense, in a practical sense, in a human sense, that I don't think it's healthy to feel that every time, if you as a devotee, because, I mean, let me clarify this before. The person who asked the question is connected to one society, spiritual society, in which the founder of the society, our Param Gurudev, Bhaktivedanta Srila Swami Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, he at times have expressed in terms of illicit sex as one of the four things to avoid when one is committing oneself to a spiritual master. He says, and it may sound scary, but I will explain it properly, so do not get that scared. No meat eating, no gambling, no illicit sex, and no intoxication. No. So that many no's may already sound a little bit intimidating. So it's a way of putting in particular framework, language, time. But the implication of all those four no's are four yes. And the four yes, which are these four yes? If I tell you, because each one of these four things, these don'ts, have to do with four, what is are called, mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, as the four pillars of dharma, of the four pillars of religion or rectitude, which are, you tell me. Huh? Loud voice, expose yourself.
Satyam, tapas.
Okay. Who is speaking there? Kriparam?
Yes.
Okay. So we have satyam or veracity, truthfulness, ahimsa, non-violence,
tapas
or austerity, and socha or cleanliness. So these are also mentioned in Yoga Sutras. These are mentioned everywhere, not only in the Bhagavatam. No, it's not only our particular neurosis that we are pointing this. Everyone is mentioned as universal values, even outside of Indian tradition. Mm-hmm. So, again, in other words, non-violence is another way of saying mercy. You know, be compassionate towards others. So, when someone is saying no meat eating, that's basically implying something that will help you to become compassionate, but it doesn't mean, oh, now I'm vegetarian, so I'm fully compassionate now. I don't need to do anything else but become vegetarian. Compassion is covered now. Next quality. No. You can become vegetarian and think everyone else is a demon because they are not vegetarian and you are not that compassionate. So you can, in the name of something, indulge in the opposite of that something. So that's like, and like this with everything. No, like, for example, to not consume like substances, abuse substances is a way of no intoxication, which is a way of cleanliness, of keeping my body and my mind clean. But again, it's not only about not indulging. Tapas. I mean, it can be connected by, yeah, in this case, it's tapas is austerity. Austerity means like, yeah, controlling certain impulses and urges and trying to keep some simple mind and body healthy one. Controlling the truthfulness or satya has to do with no gambling. So again, it's not only about no gambling. It's not that I do not go to the casino. I don't have temptation. That's why I'm perfectly truthful. Who knows? I mean, you cannot go to a casino and be a total hypocrite and liar, and so many layers of duality and hypocrisy are still there. So, but again, it's something that somehow personifies, represents something that will help in that direction. So in connection with the no illicit sex, that's connecting with the idea of cleanliness. And of course, what's the idea in this connection? The idea basically is try to keep your mind and body clean, pure. And the point, this is, again, so what's the connection with sex in the sense? That you do not overindulge in basically selfish, exploitative sensuality. Well, that's basically the idea, because, I mean, to be honest, and I don't think I need to explain this in detail, but if you engage in sex in an unhealthy way, that's not precisely productive. I mean, your senses get out of control, your mind get out of control, and of course we know that sex impulse is one of the most difficult urges, like, to control. So again, we do not expect everyone to be a brahmachari, because that's not realistic. So the point is, okay, how to deal with the sexual drive in such a way that I can grow in my practice, and at the same time I'm not like over justifying, no, my impulses in an unhealthy way in the name of, I don't know, let's be free or let's flow, do not repress. Of course, Krishna says in the Gita, you don't gain anything by repression. But he's not by that promoting anarchy, no? Like, I do whatever I like because I'm not repressing. You say, whatever I like. Actually, you are not doing whatever you like. You are just a puppet of your rajas, tamas, and sattva, the gunas of this world. And so sometimes in the name of being free, you are engaging in the topmost slavery, basically, because you don't have any control over your own mind and senses. If you want to be free, yogis will say, learn to control your mind and senses. Have control on yourself. I mean, if you can, you cannot sit and, okay, I will think about this, as we sometimes joke, speaking, okay, let's chant this mantra. And try to focus your mind on the mantra for 30 seconds. And try to control your mind and not let your mind go in somewhere else. Sometimes it's difficult. For 30 seconds, your mind is, who is in control of whom, basically. No? So if we are honest and sincere and humble, we will recognize, I need help. I need to put the house in order. I cannot just try to be free and do whatever. I cannot trust myself in the present situation that whatever I do and think is totally transcendental, because I don't have control over almost anything. So first I need some discipline, some order. I'm not speaking about dictatorship or repression, but in between point. No? Here you have totalitarianism, fundamentalism, repression, and blah, blah, blah. Here you have, what's the opposite of that in English? Libertarianism? They don't have that word? I mean, it's something similar in Spanish, but like so-called freedom, but it's just totally whimsical attitude and discipline in between, healthy discipline. How to deal with certain impulses that I may not be able to fully control today, but I also cannot just let them do whatever they like with me. So how to to gradually tame the beast, if you will. Something like that. No? So of course, so the point is that Srila Prabhupada, once when he spoke about illicit sex, he said different things to different people at different times. But somehow the general line in that connection was, sex is only to be engaged in for the purpose of procreation. So that sounds like high bar. That's basically next to being a monastic. Above a monastic even. Because like one person once told me, well, Maharaj, you are a Swami Sannyasi, so you have to control your senses, but what to speak with someone who was a lady every day next to him and has to be only, I mean, that's even harder in one sense. And I say, yes, I appreciate the point. So of course, to be realistic, that's not necessarily sustainable for everyone, and it doesn't mean that if you cannot follow that standard, you are just like cheating yourself or falling in Maya or totally whatever. So I don't think it's practical and sustainable and healthy to feel that every time you engage, every time you have sex outside of procreation, you are going against your ideal. As a devotee, I'm speaking here, because the question was as a devotee. You are going against your practice, you are engaging in illicit affairs. But again, what's the context? Again, Srila Prabhupada say different things. Sometimes he say only for procreation. Sometimes he say in a committed relationship, which it's another standard with the same idea, no? Because also it's not, you cannot just have sex here and there and everywhere with whoever you like and you cross on the street. As Guru Maharaj said, you have to, how do you say?
Draw the line
somewhere. It's not that I'm walking and I like someone and jump on the person. There is some line to be drawn on some level. Of course, there are different standards for each people. That's the point. I always share this story. Once I was with Vaishnava Maharaj in Argentina, we went to one shop. It was not a shop. It was in those times where, now it doesn't exist. It sounds like Satya Yuga, but you went to those shops that you can call other people through phone. No cell phone at that time. I don't know how you call in English, but whatever. Okay, so the person who was receiving people there, he knew a little bit of us. He were like, we were neighbors. So we all were always wearing these clothes. So one day he's asking me and him, so what's the meaning of those clothes? And we knew him a little bit. So I knew where the whole question will converge. So what's the meaning of those clothes? So we say, well, we you know us a little bit, so you know we are monastics. So that's the meaning of our clothes. We are monks. Of course, that was not his last question. That's just only the beginning. So then came the real question. So that means you don't have sex? I say, well, I mean, that's not the all in all. I mean, that's not the only thing of this, but one of the aspects of our monastic life is that, yeah, we voluntarily, because sometimes you cannot do that, we voluntarily because of our nature, conduct ourselves in a different way, if you will. But again, some other question was coming after that, so... when was the last time? He was like, you could feel... I was sorry for him. You could feel he was trying to look in his mental Google a reference point with for these weird cases he had in front of him. And the more he asked, and the more we replied, it got worse and worse for him. Because when was the last time? And maybe the reply was, there was no first time. Or the reply was 25 years ago. Or things like this. So you can imagine, he was like juggernaut, no? Like, what? And for him it was like inconceivable. And he got lost. Like when we say that, he kind of start looking like to, I don't know where, like a horizon, totally lost. And we were looking at Vaishnava, I was like, oh my God, what to do now? We were sorry for him. And after like 2-3 minutes, he returned to us and told us, I cannot spend one day without having sex. If I cannot have sex with my partner, I need to rent a prostitute or something like that. And the point is, he was kind of realizing, I have a problem. Of course, we were like an extreme case, if you will. But he was on the other extreme. So he realized, oh my God. So of course, to such a person, I won't recommend, better dress like us and become a monk and solve the problem. And he will commit suicide after 30 minutes. So to that person, I may say, try to have sex once every 2 days. Because he is accustomed to have it every day for years. So if I tell him once every week, it's like, it's too much. Once every half a week, it's too much. But he has to begin somewhere to feel some improvement and conquer that thing that is conquering him. So Srila Prabhupada, going back to the point, will say at different times, what was illicit sex again? Okay, sex outside of procreation to some people that he maybe thought they are able to sustain that standard, so you carry that standard. But to others will say sex outside of marriage or a committed relationship, because again, you have to draw the line at some point. And there were many other things he said. So my point is, he didn't say one single thing, but somehow one of those things was established as the official principle to follow, although in practice hardly anyone is following, maybe. So it's important to be honest and sincere about how to deal with that. And again, I personally, regarding the question that I mentioned, for me, Sangha Siddha, sex can be, as other drives like eating and sleeping can be Sangha Siddha Bhakti, why not sex? Why just consider sex as something like close to asuric or something in some cases, or opposite. Of course, with this I'm not like making apology, let's have sex or something like this. No, I mean, try to get the point maturely. But my point is, if you are a practitioner and you cannot just have sex for procreation, I mean, what's the point of every time you have sex? Although you're trying to be balanced in that, feeling guilt, feeling shame, feeling, oh, I'm engaging in someone who is against my practice, I'm engaging in someone unfavorable for my bhakti. Do you think that while you are trying to do your best in that connection, that's my point, no, you are not using this as an excuse. So one, I think one should sincerely acknowledge one's necessity for, and this is my main point. Actually, our necessity is not so much for sex. Our necessity is for, I would say, intimacy. And that can take many forms. I have need for intimacy, which doesn't mean I need a lady partner. And we will unfold that. So how to satisfy my necessity for intimacy in a balanced way, so I can be balanced also in our humanity, as our Guru Maharaj was saying, my horizontal development, I can be balanced human being, so I can pursue transcendence with my 2 feet on the ground and not just like whatever, using the term transcendence as some form of evasion. So on that basis, a functional sadhaka, a functional practitioner, will be able to embrace his, her own practice much more, with much more realism and sustainability, basically. than being full of guilt or shame about what they are doing in the clandestine way without telling that to anyone, even though everyone else is doing the same, but you cannot say that, although everyone knows what is something. And on the opposite, let's say, let's go to some other possibility. You can be someone who is married, who is only having sexual interaction for procreation, but you become proud of that. That can happen. And you start to judge all of the other ones who are not following your standard. And who is in a better position? You can even engage in Vaishnava Parat, in offenses to other... Maybe some other practitioner is not able to follow that standard, but is sincerely and humbly struggling, if you will, to deal with his, her different impulses and trying to work on that in a humble way, praying and taking shelter. And the other person, for some, maybe past good, some scar, is able to sustain that vow without too much effort, but is judging everyone who is not doing that. No? So at the end of the day, who is closer to Krishna, if you will. No? So again, things are not only one thing. No? So that's, for me, the important point. No, not to see all these things in black and white terms. No? You are doing, you are not doing. It's illicit or it's illicit. There are so many shades of gray in between. Like, for example, going back to these four principles. Some may say, okay, not intoxicate. Do not intoxicate, which means sometimes do not drink alcohol, do not, whatever, take cocaine, heroin, and so on. But what if you eat 1 kilogram of chocolate per day? Someone say, oh, chocolate is legal. There was in Shaman Sanda's cake yesterday. So it seems that we can do it. Yeah, but if you take 1 kilogram, that may be, you won't be overstimulated by consumption of chocolate. So that's a form of intoxication. So you follow, you can use legal stuff that are part of your day in an illegal way also. And with this, with everything. I mean, we speak no intoxication, but again, if you are being intoxicated in pride and thinking you are the best of the world, that's a form of intoxication. Or like the famous case that when I mentioned that some devotees were offending other devotees, criticizing. One devotee was criticizing other practitioners, and Srila Bhakti Pramod Puri Maharaj called him and said, before now you were eating meat, and you stopped eating meat, which is good, but now you started eating the flesh of the Vaishnavas. So I will prefer that you go back and eat meat instead of feeding yourself from the hand that is feeding you. So there is, again, there is possibility to understand these four principles in so many other ways. So many other ways. So it's not just like one thing, the other thing. So regarding sex, of course we should be willing to deconstruct also the notion that we have. Even before coming to this practice or even while being in this practice. Sometimes we may develop some misreadings of reality before or during one's practice. It's not that just now I joined the group and everything is clear and I know everything perfectly and I receive all the definitions and the concept. I have my glossary in place. So anyone asks me, what's this? I know what to say. In the beginning, one may feel that kind of immature faith, not like, okay, I get to know, this is the chamara, peacock feather, this is the arctic, and this is like this, 3 times, 2 times. I know how to do everything. So I'm legally in place. But it's not just like a mathematical formula. Where's your heart? Where's your inner world? So it's important that we are open to understand the situation of this. And again, when I say Sangha Siddha Bhakti, everything can become Sangha Siddha Bhakti. Everything can be connected with Bhakti. Also, there are levels of that, the depth of that connection. If I say, I will make my eating Bhakti. Great. Prasad, Bhagavad Prasad ki jai. Well, we offer the food in our altar. It becomes sacred remnants and we honor that. But there are levels of that also. Srila Siddha Maharaj will speak about levels of Prasad. It's not black and white. Oh, that's boga, that's prasad. That's something non-offered, offered. He will say, it depends on the consciousness of four people. The consciousness of the one who cooked, the consciousness of the one who offered, the consciousness of the one who served, and the consciousness of the one who took. If all those things are 100% in place, then you have 100% Mahaprasad. But if not, it may be some diluted situation there. You follow my point? It's not that I'm cooking and thinking any nonsense and whatever, and then I offer to Krishna, oh, now it's totally transcendental thing. No, I mean, and then I take it just to enjoy my tongue, and it keeps me in transcendental, not necessarily. So it all depends about, it's all about the matter of consciousness. So again, if eating can be Sangha Siddha Bhakti, but there are different degrees of prasad, that same idea applies with everything else, with sleeping, with sexual interaction. So there are levels of Sangha Siddha Bhakti, how to engage in all of them. So it's important to understand which is the concept of, again, of sexual activity. For example, some people say, oh, but you are from India, you speak about sex, and you are the ones who wrote the Kama Sutra, right? So most people, if you say, tell to them, tell me something about India, the ones who do not know too much, one of the first things they will say will be Kama Sutra, or something like that. Caste system, Kama Sutra, and what else? Mahatma Gandhi, and period. And of course, when they speak about Kama Sutra, they think about, oh, this is a book to enjoy sex in the best possible way. They will think that. Now, if you get a little bit informed about that, minimum education about that, you'll realize to begin with, the author of the Kama Sutra was a brahmachari. So that immediately puts, like, breaks the whole notion. Brahmachari means a celibate. So, like, what? And if you go through the whole book, only one part of the book is speaking about that. It's not that from beginning to end, from tip to toe, it's all about how to have better sex or something. And that's a section cut, edited mostly by Westerns, and they engage in a so-called tantra, and we have Kama Sutra to support our claims. But the section of the asanas, which are sexual postures in the book, is only one small part of the book. So it's like taken out of context. It's like if the people who approach yoga in the same way, they say, okay, I will approach yoga, and they think in yoga only in terms of asana. But asana is only one part of yoga. If you understand the context in which asana comes, which is the system, for example, propounded by Patanjali, you have yama niyama first. And I won't tell you what that implies because that may be too scary. So including brahmacharya, yama niyama, pranayama, asana pranayama, and then pratyahara, dharana, dhyan, samadhi. So from eight angas, one is asana. And that's in the context of other things that you have to do before, because you sit. But how can I sit if I do not carry a lifestyle that is according to that sitting? If my walking is not according to my sitting, I won't be able to sit. If I'm carrying a totally uncontrolled lifestyle, it's not that now sit and meditate. I mean, you will just meditate about all the nonsense you were doing while walking. So first, carry a lifestyle of proper behavior, proper virtue, if you will. And there you have aparigraha and all this stuff, socha, himsa, all the things we spoke. And asana is one part. So sometimes in the West they take asana and they just, let's do some postures to be more healthy, and it's okay. But do not conclude that's yoga. In the same way, do not take one chapter of Kama Sutra and say, this is Kama Sutra, this is what India is about. I mean, the book was written by one brahmachari, which means he had the intention of taking the reader close to sense control. So how to engage in sex in such a way that eventually you can transcend that even. So again, for that it's important to begin with to understand what's this drive, what's the drive behind the drive, what's the impulse behind the impulse, because sometimes we don't take the time to think about that. You just like carried away by the waves, you know? Like I feel this, I feel that. Sometimes we mix this idea, I feel. Where is that coming from? I feel. Not I, nor feel. It's just the mind dictating you. Do this, do that. And you are just obeying in a very submissive way without filter and thinking too much about that. It's not your I, it's not your Atma, your real self. And it's not real feeling. I mean, because sometimes I tell you, I feel that I would like to kill you. And I really feel that. It doesn't mean that I have to do it. We feel so many things that we have to know how to filter. Because if not, you become a serial killer or a monster, basically. So he's feeling also like drinking water. So what's the drive behind the drive? What's the impulse behind the impulse? It's important that we stop and think about that. I try to think a lot about that. I think a lot about sex, in other words. Not in the way you think about engaging and how to engage, but about what's that? What's the content of that? What's the underlying background of that particular activity? Because again, in modern world, it's totally misunderstood. They even call it make love. Like if you have a factory, no, I'm making love. No? Like, and generally, in the name of making love, which will be the greatest possible thing, love, actually we are just engaging in the most selfish type of action. Generally, people approach sex in a selfish way, exploitative way that promotes a bodily sense of identity. Again, I'm not saying there's no other way to that, but generally that's the standard. But like again, ironically, they call make love. Well, like we have the love factory here. But if I only increase in my selfishness, how much loving that is? So again, it's important to understand what is sex beyond what it seems to be. What is sex beyond what everyone, most of the people says it is, basically. No? And that's an exercise not only in relation to sex, but to anything. No? Like to not assume prematurely that we already know what everything is. But we should be open to, okay, I think sex is this, I think this is that, I think this is this. I will all be open to go beyond that, if there's a deeper layer of understanding. Because generally we have a fixed set of ideas about what is what. And we move accordingly. We have our own sambandha, which is conceptual orientation, and we, mabideya, act accordingly, and we reap certain fruits. Okay. So of course in spiritual life we are invited to recalibrate and probably deconstruct all that deeply. And that's challenging, but of course having a guru has to do with this also, to be willing for re-education. Voluntarily, I feel the need and I open myself for that. There's this famous story when two friends were to take sitar classes to one or whatever instrument, bansuri, let's say, so more or less happier. So they went to a teacher in India, and one of them had no clue about bansuri. First time he was taking bansuri, bamboo flute. And the other one was playing bansuri, but he learned by himself. So he created his own way of playing or something like that. So you can imagine how the story ends. So they go to the teacher and they ask, well, what's the price? This is my first class. I already play for myself for 20 years. So the teacher said, well, for you is the first class 50 rupees. Quite cheap. And for you who have been playing for 20 years, 300 rupees. And the other person said, but I mean, I'm so much advanced. I have been playing so much. And he said, no. You have been concocting your own way of doing things. And now first I have to work on you deconstructing what you think you know. So you begin from scratch. He's already more advanced than you because he's in scratch now. He's acknowledging that. But you think you already know how to do it while you learn the whole thing wrongly. So first I need to work extra on you. So that's why I'm charging more. So similarly, sometimes we move in life with this assumption that already we know, while we will should be open to deconstruct our sense of self. I was the other day watching one lecture from one Argentinian famous philosopher. He was explaining one quote which says, nobody can be happy. Interesting. Of course, you can feel, why you say that? Give us hope. But if you know who he is, you know he has something else in mind. He will go beyond the obvious meaning. So he says, generally, any of us are happy, mostly, he says. So if we want to become happy, okay, nobody can become happy. So nobody means that first you have to deconstruct what you think you are to the point of nobody. And accompanying that, you will have a parallel deconstructed sense of happiness in connection to the new deconstructed self. So then we can be open to the real possibility of happiness. But with your present sense of self, nobody can be happy. But if you want to be happy, then nobody can be happy. Then you got to reach the point of deconstructive self to go to that scratch and be open to, oh, there's another way that I can try this and it can work. But again, we should be willing to for engaging into the sadhana, the transformative engagement. So we have to remain open to this possibility of understanding things beyond what we think they are. It's not just that quickly, that easy. I already know what sex is, especially the things that most people think they know what it is. As Guru Maharaj will say, these words, I, love, the most used words in the universe, I, love, and the less understood words in the universe. So that's generally the paradox. The words that we use the most are the things that we understand the least. Or the acts we engage in the most, sex may be one of them for most people, maybe they are the ones that people less understand the least as well. But they don't understand what takes them to engage in that particular activity. And of course, we can be reductionist and say, well, the root background of all this stuff is avidya. No. Avidya means lack of knowledge, which guides the Atma, spiritual Atma, to act in ways that are not connected to their spiritual necessity. We can say yes, but I think most of us are not, we won't be able to take full advantage of that. You come to me, Maharaj Swami, I have a problem, this is how, I say, avidya is the root of everything. So uproot avidya, and everything's solved. And that's true, but you may need some further unpacking of the sutra, basically, no? So the same with this, you can say, Maharaj, I have problems with the sex issue. And I can tell, that's because you are identifying with the body, identify with the Atma. Atma doesn't need to engage in sex, and that's all. Because of avidya, you are misidentifying who you are. So you understand who you are, problem solved. What do you think? Is that easy? Of course, it's important to get to know those concepts, but then how to play them out in a sustainable way that I do not go neurotic and I do not end up in the madhouse in the name of being transcendental. That's also another layer of conversation. So as we mentioned, when we are trying to become transcendentalists, we are part of that project. We want to be transcendentalists in one form or another, one level or another. But we have to be very careful of not misunderstanding transcendence as evasion, like, or negativity. I don't want this. This is bad. No. Of course, sometimes we express things in terms of don'ts, but we have also to bear in mind that don't has a corresponding do. So our practice has a positive content in whatever we are doing, and we are just not conceiving transcendence as not doing stuff, but a positive engagement, a more positive. How do you say, Silasya Maharaj?
Positive immortality.
Subjective.
Positive, progressive.
Positive and progressive immortality, Silasya Maharaj will say. That's our idea of transcendence. Not just neti-neti. Not this, not that, not that. And what remains after such a process? So, for me, I always like to define transcendence as integration, not as evasion, as indifference. Because in the name of transcendence, you can just become indifferent. And you can, your heart can become a harder rock than it already is. So transcendence actually means integration, how to give a place to everything in my project. Of course, which can take different forms, again, because you can ask, okay, Mara, so how you integrate sex in your life? Because you are monastic. So there is a place for integrate? Yeah, there is a place for integrating everything. But of course, we have to understand sex beyond our present idea of what is. As I mentioned before, one way of understanding sex beyond the necessity for intimacy I mentioned is like creative energy. I mean, in Shastra many times that's the term for that. Kriya Shakti. No. Because the natural, generally, the natural result of the sexual interaction may be a procreation. Not always, but generally. So there's a creation involved, a creative act involved. So there's an energy that tends towards that direction. And of course, you can know that, you may imagine that the only way to express our creativity is not necessarily only through sex. So you can be creative in so many ways. And you can channel and dovetail and express that particular Shakti, that particular tendency, in so many ways. So I'm trying to do my best in that sense in a monastic context. You can do that by singing and writing and speaking with you and thinking, so many ways, cooking. Sakyarati will show us her Kriya Shakti. She always does something new in the kitchen. She's cooking? There's always something new coming. Yeah. And so many others, of course. No? Or dressing the deity. I mean, so many artful, willful creativity can be there. Not necessarily limited to this particular act. Which, again, can be one aspect of that, but it's not the only thing. That's my point. And the other way is intimacy. Again, all of us need intimacy. I mean, we are social animals, if you will, social beings. So, and again, intimacy is not necessarily only physical. Of course, some people will need that and will need to be hugged more than others. Some other people don't like hugs at all. I won't give examples. But also, the more we... It all depends about also our sense of identity. If I mostly identify on the bodily platform, I will experience a need of intimacy on the bodily platform. If my sense of being is more situated on the mental, psychological platform, I will experience a need of intimacy in that regard. And if I'm more situated on the spiritual platform, I will feel a need for spiritual intimacy. So, but all will need intimacy. That's my point. No? And of course, we try to satisfy that in so many ways. For example, we as practitioners, a very simple way of experiencing intimacy is in sadhu sangha, in relation to one another, in close connection, in confidence, opening our hearts, what Rupa Goswami would call guhyamakyati prichati, which means reveal your mind in confidence to another like-minded practitioner, which is not, it's like, I mean, like people get naked when having sex. When you reveal your mind to someone, you are naked. Even in a more naked way. You follow? So that's intimate. I mean, the other person is totally vulnerable in front of you, opening like everything, which is like, we may feel like, oh, should I do that or not? But you feel the need. And you need to open your heart to show as you are without filter, without any show. And you need someone on the other side who is capable of dealing with your vulnerability, who won't exploit that, but who will nourish. I mean, as we always say, vulnerability can create disaster if you expose yourself to the wrong person, or vulnerability can create empowerment if you show yourself to the proper, to the right person who knows what to do with your fragility. You will be empowered. So to reveal our minds means to be sincere enough. We are not trying to hide anything. We're trying to be ourselves as much as we can, allowing the other person. I mean, that's really intimate. And actually, sometimes sex, although it's one form of intimacy, it may be a way of evading the other type of intimacy also. And you just remain on a superficial bodily platform without being able to go beyond it. Rupa Goswami also say, Bishram Bena Guru Seva. Relate with your guru with a sense of deep friendship and trust. That's another way of saying intimacy. Visramba is another way from intimacy. Interestingly, the word prasanga also means that, an intimate connection with devotees. And in Sanskrit, instead, indeed, one of the many words for sexual activity is sangha or prasanga, which means intimate association. So again, you apply that to so many forms it takes. Intimate physical association, intimate spiritual association, deep trust, confidence, all this. But the principle is ideally the same. So it's important to understand the things. No, actually, when you feel I feel the need for sex. Actually, you feel the need for expressing your creative energy and for intimacy. So with this, I'm not saying, so therefore, stop having sex and do something else. But if you understand the background of that, that will help you a lot to deal with that necessity in so many, in much more even productive ways. What to speak if you are a monk. I mean, you need to know what to do with those drives, because if not, in the name of monasticism, you become crazy. And I've seen some dysfunctional monks that, unfortunately, they were not able to address the issue more maturely and just end up jumping from the repressive extreme to the other extreme, basically. And that's not the idea, that's not the solution. So it's important to understand all the things. And how most of the sexual need we perceive is mostly arising in our minds. No, it's not something that we totally need to do in every single case. I'm saying this not to, again, to feel bad if we are doing that, but just to not over, like, give that an over dimension, if you will, that I really need and I will always need and forever. This is the topmost priority. Like this friend of mine was thinking when he said, not even a single day without that. So again, we need to to understand the nature of that desire, the nature of that necessity. We have so many necessities, perceived necessities, but the more we get enlightened, we start to deconstruct the background of them and understand what's the real necessity and how something is a symptom of something that could be worked on, and we can sustain that in a more. But again, my point is, if you are a practitioner and you do not, I mean, you are not a monastic, which 99% of the practitioners are not. So you need to know what to do with your sex drive. So basically, the idea is, as our Guru Maharaj says, try to engage, I mean, try to control that urge as much as you can and try to satisfy your need for intimacy in so many ways. But also, there is place to express that in a committed relationship in such a way that may promote healthy balance in your humanity, healthy relationship with your partner that may feel that same necessity. Of course, I know that sometimes that's a problem. One part of the partnership feels a degree of necessity and the other does not. So you have to sign the contract in some way or another. So, but yeah, these are things that we have to deal with in a realistic way. There's one devotee, Jai Jagannath Prabhu, a friend of mine, that he had given some, I haven't seen them, but I know him, so I trust he had given very interesting talks in connection to this point, so speaking openly about how to deal with that and not how to hide that and end up being dysfunctional. I also remember a series of articles written by Satyanarayan Das Babaji when he spoke about delusional disorders in the Vaishnava community. So how in the name of ecstasy, in the name of self-control, in the name of so many things that seem very nice, you're actually expressing some dysfunctional disorder. And you need to detect that properly in order to not mistake that word for, oh, he's an abadut. No, he needs therapy. Things like that, no? But again, that said, it's important to understand also that the sex drive is something that, yeah, it's to be integrated. Again, it's not only the activity in itself, but it's energy, it's creativity, it's intimacy, and that can take so many forms. So it's good not to think like, okay, sex is bad, no, or this is bad. Sometimes we feel the need to demonize something in order to, like, reassure ourselves. I'm the correct place, and this is bad, and this is bad. I mean, there's nothing bad. The only bad thing is how we approach things with the wrong conception. I mean, killing is not bad. If you kill your ego, that's good. That's what Krishna is promoting in the Gita. Kill. Of course, you have to understand the Bhagavad Gita. If not, you become a serial killer, per se. But he speaks about killing. And there's a place for killing, if you know how to integrate that. So the same with everything else. I mean, Krishna in the Gita says the same thing. He says, Dharma viruddha bhuteshu kamashmi. I'm the sexual drive that is not against Dharma. For himself, saying, I'm pleasant there when one is engaging in that activity, in the context of Dharma, no? In the context of becoming righteous and virtuous and religious. So it's all about our own sincerity, and you can judge the tree by its fruit. No? What's that particular engagement invoking in myself? Is helping me to be more sensitive, more human, better practitioner, or is degrading myself, becoming more selfish? I mean, you have to consult that with your pillow at night, basically, you know, what's coming. So, some thoughts about that. I'm sorry, I see there are many questions. This is an important question. That was a good question. And of course, also one more thing that it may be a little bit too much, but it's important to mention, to make full circle. And at the beginning of the lecture, I spoke how this talk is connected to today's celebration, which is the Tirubhav Mahotsav of Sri Jayadev Goswami. So what does Jayadev Goswami has to do with all this? Of course, one way of connecting, Jayadev Goswami is a very famous Vaishnav who appeared like 300 years before Mahaprabhu. And he stayed some time in Navadvip, he stayed some time in Vrindavan, he stayed some time in Jagannath Puri. He's especially famous in Jagannath Puri because he wrote this great poem called Gita Govinda. So Gita Govinda is a song, it's a poem he wrote in which a very detailed account of the romantic life of Radha and Krishna is presented there. I had the blessings of Guru Maharaj to study Gita Govinda some months ago when I was in Radha Kund. So it was a particularly powerful combination. And it's a very beautiful book, but of course you have to know how to approach it, because at least in my personal case, I've not seen any more detailed description of the romantic union of Radha and Krishna than in Gita Govinda. And romantic union implies also sexual union. Because sometimes we speak about Radha and Krishna, romanticism, and we may say, they sing, they dance, they embrace, they kiss. Stop. Period. Yeah. No, there's more. And of course, we do not enter into those details generally, because we need certain adhikar for dealing with those realities ourselves. First, we need to, again, know how to deal with the sexual principle here in order to understand the sexual principle there. Adirasa is called in Sanskrit, the original relationship, if you will. So yes, God has sexual life also. I mean, you cannot deny that, repress that. Of course, you cannot just run into that and try to know all the details, because probably you are not ready for that. Generally, those who can enter there are those who are totally self-controlled, who have controlled those urges, who are in control of themselves and who are in control of this world. Sometimes, I remember one series of articles written by one devotee called Hare Kirtan. I think they are in the Arharmonies. The articles are Sex, Death, and Yoga. He makes some interesting points. Of course, you have to understand the whole context, but he makes like, okay, sex is the cause of death, basically, because if you have sex, someone is born, and if you are born, you will be dead. So if you want to conquer death, you have to conquer sex. He makes some interesting points. He's not, again, denial anything, but making some points. I mean, and that's why sometimes the ones who have conquered their senses and their minds, and therefore all these urges, Vacho Vigam Manasa Krodha Vigam Jiva Vigam Udaro Pashta Vigam Etam Vigam Jovisai Tadira Sarvam Aprimam Pritivim Sisyat Sisila Rupa Goswami. He who controls the impulse of speech, Vacho Vigam Manasa Krodha, he can control their mind, he can control anger. Jiva Vigam Udaro Pashta Vigam, he can control his tongue, the desire for tasting, his stomach and his genital organ, that person can make disciples in the whole world. Or that person can make the whole world his disciple or her disciple. That person has conquered the world. And the world has to do with birth and death, somehow. So sometimes that idea is given. So, again, to enter into a detailed description of the sex life of God, that's for very highly realized personalities. But we should at least know that exists. And somehow, in that sense, sex is not to be condemned, because, I mean, that's an important part of Krishna's life. But it's not what we think it is. You will fully understand that once you have all your senses under control. So that's an important point. We are not trying like to rush into those realities, but also to acknowledge that's possible, even in the most, hardly the most sensual part of the Bhagavatam, which is not that sensual compared to Gita Govinda, Rasa Lila, Krishna dancing with the gopis and singing and having some romantic interaction in the consummation of their relationship. The very last verse of the Rasa Panchadhyaya, these five chapters, which is called the Phal Shruti, which is the fruit of hearing God's sensual interaction with thousands of ladies at night. Vikriditam brajabadhu viridam cha vishnu. What else? No? Vikriditam brajabadhu viridam cha vishnu. Shradana srinuyalata varna yedyat. One word missing. Bhaktim param bhagavati pratilabhya kaman. Srila Sukadeva Goswami, we mentioned the other day, Sukadeva Goswami was totally self-controlled, but was attracted to hear about this quote-unquote sensual stuff. And he was not agitated by that. He was agitated in a transcendental way. And he said, the fruit of hearing these affairs of Krishna with the gopis is that one will conquer lust. Taste. But you may say, but when you hear those stories, it seems the stories are about lust. But when you understand what they are about, actually, that understanding will help you to conquer your lust, your selfish desire. Because Krishna is engaging romantically with his shaktis, with the gopis, with his potencies. But one of the six qualities of Bhagavan is what? Supreme renunciation. So that's the very first word of the Rasa Panchadhyaya. Bhagavan api ratri. The first word of the five chapters on Rasa Lila is Bhagavan. So implying he is engaging in all this. And who is Bhagavan? Among other things, the one who is supremely renunciate. In other words, he has no attraction to mundane sensuality, even though it seems he's engaging in that. So I mentioned this as another way of giving a place to sex, even in the Nitya Lila, even in connection to God's life. But again, we have to recalibrate our approach to all these realities, to all these concepts, and make them healthy and sustainable. And making a clear difference, of course. Lust or selfish desire is based on exploitation, is based on taking, is based on experiencing something quick and cheaply, and that's not healthy. And it's just immediate thing. Like you have the classical experience that Prahlad Maharaj gives, and you can have experience here, is the... How do you say, when some mosquito or bug is like biting you and you want like to scratch, you say? Mm-hmm. Huh? And you know what will happen by doing that. I mean, that's not the medicine. That's not the ultimate solution. It's just immediate temporary relief. And you even say, it's pleasure. It's not pleasure. It's relief from suffering. Pleasure is something else. You say, how pleasure is it? Wait 10 seconds. Double anxiety now. You scratch again. Wait 5 seconds. Triple anxiety. Till you make a hole in your leg by scratching that much. And you say, you have to stop. Stop. You have to tie your arms and tolerate. And understand. With understanding, tolerate. So lust sometimes is depicted as such by Prahlad. You feel this. But when you stop doing that, the thing comes with double force now. And you feed it again. Krishna says in the Gita. Try to feed the monster of selfish desire, whatever it may be. It's like a monster in the sense that you give something and it immediately will ask, give me double. It's never satisfied. No matter how much you throw into the fire, you will ask for more and for more and for more, and you become more and more slave by that. You do not have time to do anything else but to attend the demands of that, give me more, give me more. And it's like, oh my God. There are many prayers in the scriptures about that. Like, I better go to war with another boss. Oh, this is a dictator. So that's selfish desire. That's lust. That's not love, even if it takes the form of whatever. Real love is based, as our Guru Maharaj will teach us, in giving and sacrifice. In a glorious way, in a voluntary way. So even if there is proper spirit of giving, spirit of sacrifice, sexual life can be there in a proper context, and that can be a healthy and sustainable ingredient for a practitioner in whatever stage he or she may be. Anyhow, I got too long today, so there are 1, 2, 3, 4 more questions. But here we are almost on time, and we will have prasad in some minutes. We will try to honor prasad in the best possible level of Sangha Siddha Bhakti. So excuse me that I extended myself a little bit on this topic, but I consider it will be interesting. So I hope that helped. And if there are any remaining questions, we will have another Stagosi or Q&A.
Thursday?
Sorry?
Thursday,
yeah. That's on Thursday. Of course, it won't be the same time, so I know that for some of you it may be too late or too early or whatever. But it will be at our 6:30 p.m. So for those who can come, or if you cannot connect, but some of those questions you would like to be answered, you can please send me the questions again via private message. And I won't say I promise, but I will try my best to give shorter answers so we can have time for addressing all of these questions. So thank you so much for your time. Srila Gurudev ki jai. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai. Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai. Sri Sri Dauji Gopal ki jai. Tirubhav Mahotsav Titi Sri Jayadev Goswami ki jai. Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai. Gaur Premanand.